It's time to kick back and grab a beer, because the space cadets are here. Talking about space and the universe, let's all be giant science nerds. We're the space cadets, yeah, we're the space cadets.
Welcome back, space cadets, to episode 6 of our podcast. We have some very familiar voices here with us today in both Will and Mark. And we are also very lucky to have a very special guest with us on the show. He's an engineer, an aircraft pilot, a retired U.S. Air Force officer, a former NASA astronaut and mission specialist across 3 shuttle missions in which he accumulated more than 350 hours in space. And most recently, the author of the amazing book, Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut. Please welcome to the show, Colonel Mike Mullane. Mike, thank you so much for being with us today and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Todd, Will, and Mark. I'm looking forward to it.
So, you know, we've all taken some time and we've read your book, and it's honestly, it's an amazing, amazing story. What was your inspiration to writing it? Obviously, the content in it speaks for itself, but what made you think, you know what, I should sit down and write about this stuff?
Well, I had lived an interesting life, having been, you know, flying in the Air Force, been in Vietnam, and in the space shuttle business. I just felt I would give it a shot and see what it sounded like after I started typing, and it turned out to be relatively well received by people. So it was just, I wanted to tell my life story. I just felt like posterity, my children, my grandchildren, would be nice to have something out there that they could always remember me by.
I have to ask, I was curious about this when I picked up my copy. Is that you on the cover?
No, it's not. That was Simon & Schuster that did that. One of their artists just thought it would be kind of cool to put something unusual that might draw people into picking up the book and at least reading a few lines of it and perhaps buying it. I thought it was very clever. Initially when I saw it, I thought, oh, it's kind of odd. But I think it's very clever. Now, the photo in the background of that shuttle out on the lake bed, actually, that was a photo taken at Edwards Air Force Base on my last landing of the actual Atlantis out there on the lake bed runway.
Oh, that's so cool. It sounds like from within the book, you started with an interest in both aviation and space at a very early age, probably stemming from your family's military association. I especially liked your stories about building homemade bottle rockets with your dad. And it sounds like, at least in some cases, he put himself right in the line of fire for some of your experiments.
These weren't bombs. These were pipe bombs with fins. It's amazing I'm still alive after doing this. But no, this is back. I was a child of the space race. I was 12 years old when Sputnik was launched in 1957. I was already at that time fiercely interested and involved with aviation because of my dad's career in the Air Force. But also the space program, even before Sputnik. I was reading everything I could about space and science and flying, and I was all in. So as soon as Sputnik occurred, I started building homemade rockets and launching these things. As I said, they were very, looking back on it, I'm amazed that I'm still alive or have my eyes and hands, given how dangerous it was. Homemade rocket fuel mixed up at home and put in steel pipes and going out in the desert and launching these things, incredibly dangerous. But I was, as I said, all in, and I wanted to learn more and more about space. I read everything that they could that was out there. There was a book, Conquest of Space, by Willie Ley and what was his name? Bonestell is the artist, I believe, that I just absolutely loved. It had some paintings of what it was going to be like for astronauts on Mars and these other in the moon. And just as I said, I was all in. I had a single passion that was devoted to space and science.
You know, in the danger that you maybe put yourself in building those pipe bombs with fins, I think what probably struck me as the most amazing thing from personal experience is that your mom let you dismantle that vacuum cleaner to make the tubing for the rocket. Because I can imagine asking my mom to take apart her vacuum to go build a pipe bomb and what her reaction would have been.
Yeah, my parents were very supportive of my interest in these homemade rockets. Too supportive, frankly. years later, I asked my mom, what were you thinking allowing me to do this? And She said, well, I thought you knew what you were doing. And I told her, I said, when does a teenage boy ever know what he's doing? You know, this was insanity. And they, you know, aided me in it. My dad take me out there, take me to the machine shops to have the nozzles lathed at a machine shop, and take me to buy the chemicals necessary to mix my propellants. And they were all in on it, and God bless them for it. But wow. I sure look back on it and think of the danger that was involved in launching these things.
Fast forwarding a little bit, you joined the military. You flew, I think the number I read was 134 combat missions in Vietnam. There's one specific one I want to talk about, but is that correct?
Yes. I was in the intro, you said I was a fighter or Air Force pilot. That is, let me correct you on that. I was not an Air Force pilot. I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be a test pilot. And when I went into the Air Force out of West Point, I could not be a pilot because my eyesight was poor. So I ended up in the backseat of fighters. As I explained to people, if you saw Top Gun, there's Maverick and Goose. I guess there's another Top Gun 2 coming out.
There is.
With geriatric Tom Cruise in there. But at any rate, I was a goose in the backseat of fighters. That was what I was doing in the Air Force. Wasn't a pilot. But yeah, that I interrupted you, but I went to Vietnam flying in the back of the Phantom jet is what I was doing over in Vietnam.
And one of the stories in there that I heard, and I've always wondered this, I've been skydiving. I don't know, Mark and Will, have you guys ever skydived?
I have not.
Yet.
Okay. So I did it for my 18th birthday, Mike, and it was the most terrifying experience of my life, hanging my legs out of that plane and knowing I had the option to jump or not jump, but knowing that I had to do it or else, you know, I'd look bad to everybody on the ground. There's a story that you wrote about the when you ejected from an F-111. And that is something I would love to hear. What goes through your mind? You know, I had the choice to go back in the plane. I think you were at zero fuel, or bingo fuel, I think is the term that you used in the book. What is that like to make that decision?
Well, I don't really remember. I was, you know, kind of the setup here. The pilot lost control of the plane attempting to land with a very low fuel state. I won't go into more details than that in the interest of time. But it was obvious to me that we were going to die. He was fighting the airplane, trying to land, and at a kind of a last second, I just remember I reverted to my training. I remember in our training, they always said, when in doubt, punch out. You know, they could always buy another plane, but nobody wants to go on your wife. She's now a widow. I remember my commander talking to us about that. And I don't remember any conscious decision making. Should I, shouldn't I? I just reached for the ejection handle and pulled it. And that was very fortunate because there was no question looking back on it and in the accident investigation afterwards that, you know, we very, 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 very close to dying on that thing. If I hadn't ejected, I think there's no question we would have died. But when I pulled the handle, I remember one of the things that you hear about how in very time-critical, life-threatening situations, how time seems to slow down. That's true, because I remember pulling that ejection handle. And to me, it seemed like nothing was happening. And then I heard this loud bang, and I felt this pressure on my body as the rocket motor fired to eject this capsule. The entire cockpit is ejected on the F-111. And so I felt that rocket fire. But to me, it seemed like it took a very, very long time. And I was talking to one of the aerodynamics manufacturer of the plane that was doing some look at how everything functioned after the ejection, and he said that's a fraction of a couple tenths of a second from the time you pull the handle to the time it actually separates. But to me, it seemed like it was a very long time. And so but I'm glad I pulled it. There's no question that I think we would have been dead if I hadn't.
So fast forwarding in the book, you almost ejected from a T-38. But you made the decision not to after, what was it, ATC confirmed that there was fire. So, right, you know, having said you had absolutely no regrets about pulling that handle, Yeah, how does it compare when you see the other end of it, where, you know, there was great potential for danger, but where you decided not to?
Well, that was a totally different situation, in the fact that we were in control. The place was in control, setting up the story, a takeoff out of El Paso in the backseat of a T-38 NASA jet. As we were lifting off from the ground, the tower reported that we were on fire. We were trailing along a long flame, and I could see it flickering in the mirror in the back seat. It turned out that one of the afterburner plumbing systems had failed, so there was this huge amount of fuel was being dumped into the kind of the bottom of the belly in the back, and it was burning, and that was what was trailing that fire. It ultimately burned a hole in the bottom of the aircraft back toward the back, but all we knew at the time is that we were on fire. Well, the checklist says confirmed fire, you're supposed to eject. And, of course, we had a confirmed fire in the sense that the tower was telling us we're on fire. But the plane was flying fine, and we had no indications in the cockpit that there was anything wrong, except for one little indication that the nozzle on one of the engines wasn't in the right position. So the pilot assumed that was the problem engine, shut that down, and we declared an emergency and came back and landed. Now, throughout this thing, I'm worried, and he is too, about what's going on back there, what else is burning, and could have burned through some flight controls. Because once you get to a low altitude, you're out of what they call the envelope to eject. If you try ejecting very low to the ground, you're not going to make it because you won't have a time to get enough altitude to get a parachute deployed. So it was one of those agonizing decisions. Do I, don't I, what do I do? And I just stuck with it this time. And fortunately, it worked out fine. There was a hole burned in the bottom of the aircraft, but we were able to land successfully.
So you were probably, what, that was 1977, I think, when you were chosen out of the 8,000 applicants to become part of the candidate program. So you were probably 32 around at the time?
Yeah, I was 32 when I was selected as an astronaut.
So I am just about 32, Mike, and I think about the decisions I have to make every day. And I don't know about you, Will or Mark. I don't know if we've ever been faced with anything even a tenth of that. Oh my God, I can't
not even remotely.
Well, you jumped out of a perfectly good airplane, so I think you're nuts.
the beginning part of that story I didn't mention was that my mom jumped with me, and she went first, so I couldn't let her get all the glory on the ground, you know?
Oh, really? Your mom did it? Did you go tandem, or was this a free solo static line deployment?
Oh, I wish I trusted myself that much. No, it was a tandem. It was our first jump ever. I've been telling my parents since I was young that I wanted to go for my 18th birthday. So on my 18th birthday, they took me up. My dad, who will be listening to this, chickened out, stayed on the ground to watch us. And then my mom had no qualms, jumped straight out the plane. And I was like, well, I got to go now. What am I going to do? My mom's a badass. So
I was gonna say, man, that would be a tough one to live down. Say, yeah, I chickened out, and my mom did it.
That's it. Especially on the 18th birthday, you got a lot to prove at that age, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So you were one of 200 selected out of that 8,000, and then you guys, there was 35 of you that actually, I think, made it through to become full-fledged astronauts. Although I know you say you don't get your gold wings till you hit that 50. Was it 50,000 mile mark?
50 miles.
50 miles.
Yeah.
So the TFNGs, as you refer to them, which I got to tell you, I thought in the beginning when I started reading the book that acronym meant something else.
It did. Well, first of all, your summary there is correct. I was, there were about 8,000 applicants for the first class of space shuttle astronauts. I applied. They winnowed that down to about 200, come down to interview and do physicals. I was able to make that cut. And I was, from that cut, I was able to, that cut of 200, I was able to, fortunately enough, to get selected to be a mission specialist astronaut. So that's how that worked. But anyway, there were 35 of us, which was a very large group for astronaut selection. In fact, the largest I think there's ever been. As I said, it was supposed to be for the first, it was the first group for the space shuttle operations. And it's not a requirement that classes name themselves. It just sort of happens. And since we were 35 new guys, we called ourselves the TFNGs. But actually, FNG is an acronym in the military, at least when I was in the military, that had obscene connotations. It was effing new guy. You know, somebody was new to a squadron, and they say, well, that's the effing new guy. And so when we picked that TFNG, there were a lot of military people in the group. And so we picked that name with that connotation, knowing that other people within the military would understand what it was, but within flight company and, of course, NASA's PR system, it was we were known as the 35 new guys, TFNGs, and are to this day, frankly. That's our class name.
I love it.
I've got to rewind to right before, or I guess during that selection process. You mentioned the fact that you drove your own medical records over to, I guess, the selection committee. How do you think it would have impacted your odds of being chosen if you had left that dossier complete?
That story there is in the book about I had whiplash from that ejection, and I didn't want that to be in front of a NASA doc, worrying that they would disqualify me for some injury, neck injury. So I kind of edited the flight records as I was flying over to do this interview. Looking back on it, it would not have had any effect. As it turned out, well, first of all, military people are deathly afraid of flight surgeon, at least in my era, because you can't, when you go in to get a physical with a flight surgeon, you can't somehow win. There's only one thing you can do, two things you can do. Either there's no change and you're still on flying status, or you're off flying status because now you have high blood pressure or some other issues. So going to the flight surgeon for a physical when you're a military officer is never fun. And so I had that mentality going into NASA. As it turned out, the NASA flight surgeons were oriented toward keeping you on flight status, doing everything necessary to ensure that you remained on flight status. So looking back on it, it would not have had any effect had I just not bothered and just presented my medical records from the Air Force as they were.
So, Mike, one of the things you just mentioned was with the TFNGs, it was a military saying. You go into some detail in the book about the difference between military astronaut candidates as well as civilian astronaut candidates. And I'll leave the spoilers for the readers of your book on your feelings there. But my question to you is, there's a lot more commercialization of space. In fact, one of our earlier episodes talked about this. When you think about companies like SpaceX or Blue Origin trying to make getting into space a bit easier with renewable rockets, but also eventually colonization of the moon and Mars and so on and so forth. How do you feel? What's your take on that? What's your take on companies starting to take more of the reins of space travel, or at least take a bigger part of it in conjunction with NASA?
Well, initially, I was a skeptic, a critic, really, when it first came out back in 2008, I believe it was, that NASA was going to privatize low Earth orbit. But I've come full circle on that. I think that was a very smart decision. It's what SpaceX and some of these other Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic and all these companies have done. It's light years faster than NASA would have been able to do because of the, you know, just working within the government. These private companies are much, much more nimble and can take greater risks when they're developing their rockets and really press ahead. So I'm all for what the privatization of low Earth orbit. And frankly, I'm excited about the idea that there's going to be a lot of people being able to share in the space experience. I do think, though, that people should be prepared for it. Is there going to be some losses? I mean, we're not going to go into the private space tourist operation not have any losses. There's going to be some catastrophic losses along the way. It's just the nature of the business. Just as there was in early aviation, But I'm confident that even in the light of those losses, you know, human beings are very resilient. They'll want to continue to fly. And these companies, even after suffering losses, will sustain a robust civilian space tourist or whatever you want to call it, operation.
Yeah, it's something that we all would love the opportunity to do. I think the closest we could get to it right now is what do they call it? The Comet rocket, the plane that goes up and down, those big parabolic curves that lets you feel weightless for about 30 seconds. I think you talk about that a bit. The Vomit Comet.
Vomit Comet, right. Well, good luck with that. I hated every ride I had of that. And looking back on it, it had zero advantage to preparing you for weightlessness up in space. It just was an exercise in trying to prevent vomiting. While you're riding that thing, it really, having those sequential 30 seconds of weightlessness followed by a 2G pull out to climb up, another 30 seconds of weightlessness, 2G, very, very nauseating. And it's not the same as being permanently in weightlessness as occurs when you reach orbit. So I think there's zero training given in to flying that thing, preparing for low Earth orbit. The only thing that's good for is if you want to evaluate some machine that you're going to put up on a space station or whatever, you could at least do some work on that. But preparing a human, no, it doesn't do a thing for you.
So Mike, I want to shift focus a little bit and talk about some of your missions. So you were on three separate shuttle missions. You were on the first flight of the Discovery, the STS-41D, the third flight of Atlantis, that was STS-27, and then the sixth flight of Atlantis, STS-6. So I know your first flight had some hiccups in terms of some abort protocols that had to be followed, one of which seems like it was incredibly serious. So before we even talk about what it was like once you got off the launch pad, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind walking us through what those nerves felt like and what it felt like when that countdown reached six and then paused.
Well, that first flight, my first flight was the 12th flight in the shuttle series. It was the first flight, as you said, of the Orbiter Discovery. And I was the mission specialist aboard that. We had three communication satellites we were going to deploy in a solar cell experiment. But the 11 previous missions all counted down to T-minus 6 seconds, the three liquiding and started. They passed the computer check, which at that point, as soon as you get a green light on passing, the computers get a green light on passing all of those checks, the computers issue the command to explode the whole down bolts and fire the solid rocket boosters, and then there's no going back. So 11 previous times before my first flight, that occurred exactly as I just described. But on my first flight, we got down to T-minus 6 seconds. The three liquid engines started. And you're scared. I'll tell you right now, when you're out on that launch pad, you're scared. And so we have these engine vibrations grip us at T-minus 6 seconds. And I remember thinking, well, whatever happens, I'm going now. 5, 4, 3. And at 3 seconds, the computer detected one of the engines wasn't functioning properly, and so it shut them all off. It's called a bad abort, and shut all the engines off. So the computers did exactly what they're designed to do. But in this situation for us, anytime you have a surprise like this, when things don't go the way you expect, obviously that ratchets up the fear. But the added fear factor on that particular mission was when the launch control reported seeing a fire at the base of the vehicle, not on the vehicle as it turned out, but on the launch pad at the bottom of the vehicle. They reported it to us in the cockpit as a small fire, but as I tell people here, when you're on top of 4 million pounds of explosive propellant, there's no such thing as a small fire. So that really, really ratcheted up the fear factor in the cockpit. But fortunately, they were able to turn on the fire suppression system on the launch pad, which deluged the launch pad and, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water to get the fire out. And they sent a crew out to extract us from the cockpit and came back about 2 months later and and finally made it into orbit on our second launch attempt 2 months later.
Wow. And so when you finally get past that point of six and it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and those engines kick in, I mean, you've been obviously flying everything under the sun and some of the most crazy aircraft that we could even imagine. I mean, try and draw a comparison there. Is this like going from a skateboard to a Ferrari? What is this? What does this feel like?
That is probably as good an analogy as any, but there's no aviation experience I ever had to compare with launching on a space shuttle. When you're out there on the pad, as I mentioned, you have a sense of the immense danger that space flight entails, machines associated with it. So you know your life's on the line. The thing about the space shuttle, too, that is makes it a little more apprehensive to get aboard these things is back then there's no escape system. There was no way to bail out of the shuttle. At least in the fighter jets that I flew, there was always an ejection system. So you had some sense that if things really went bad, you had a final way of escaping, hopefully a catastrophic failure. But on the shuttle, you had no escape system. And so that really was an uncomfortable feeling out on that launch pad. But when the engines start, you get this heavy vibration in the cockpit. At zero, the hold-down bolts blow. There's four explosive bolts on the skirts of each of the solid rocket boosters that hold the vehicle to the pad while the three liquid engines are starting and being checked by computers. But when those are exploded apart, there's no going back. The solid rocket boosters are ignited simultaneously or a couple of milliseconds later. But you're on your way. You're slapped into your seat with about a 2G force as those boosters ignite and you're released from the pad. Those G-forces will increase to about 2.5. And then 2 minutes up, the boosters burn out. You hear a loud bang. You see this fire across the windscreens as these things are blowing away. The expended boosters are. And then you continue into space on the three liquid-fueled engines for another 6.5 minutes. And the Gs then will ultimately rise to three Gs, three times the force of gravity. And that's about the last minute or so before you reach orbit. At that point, the engines start throttling back to keep you from exceeding 3 Gs. And just the vehicle starts pitching ever closer to being horizontal with the Earth as it accelerates into the final sprint to reach that 17,500 mile an hour point. And at that point, engines stop, jettison the gas tank, fire some smaller engines for few minutes to get a couple hundred miles an hour extra to stabilize us in orbit, and now you're weightless. So not 8.5 minute ride, white knuckle all the way.
And I know you're worried about getting sick, and you yourself didn't take any medicine, but it sounds like one of your crewmates may not have been so lucky on that first launch.
Yeah, that space sickness is a baffling thing. About half the astronauts experience this nausea once they reach weightlessness, and it has no correlation whatever to Earth motion sickness. In other words, if you get seasick, car sick, plane sick, roller coaster sick, any of those type of things, it will not predict whether you're going to get sick in weightlessness or not. You may not. It's just impossible to predict. Doctors have never been able to figure out what causes it, and frankly, how to prevent it. They can treat it, and they do now with some industrial strength anti-nausea injections to prevent people from having this distracting nausea. But on my first mission, one of the crew members was vomiting up in front, and that's disgusting. We carry bags, barf bags, but they don't do a very good job. It's hard to contain fluids in weightlessness, frankly. And so now there were some little blobs of barf in the cockpit. Just small bits of it. It wasn't blobs, but it's just disgusting. But again, I expected to get sick. I had barf bags in every pocket. I was ready to be sick because I'd been sick in the backseat of fighter jets countless times. I've been seasick. Anytime I've been on a boat, I've been seasick. Hate roller coasters and those type of rides. Get sick on those. But up in space, I had no sickness, none whatsoever, not a hint of it. And that's why I say it's not correlated to Earth motion sickness. Whatever causes it, you just won't know until you get up there. It was disgusting when people are vomiting in that cockpit. It could last for somebody, you know, just one or two times up to maybe a week long, or even some people have been affected more than a week. So a baffling phenomena.
Wow. And so what happens first? You know, I have to assume, because there was one gentleman on the flight who it was his second, but everybody else on your first mission, I think it was also their first mission. Is that correct?
That's correct. There were five people aboard, and there were six people aboard. They had a payload specialist, and the only veteran on that flight was the commander, Hank Hartsfield.
And so do they give you some time to just sort of take it all in? You quoted it as saying you sort of feel this detachment from humanity, but I just imagine it would be amazing to just take it in for an hour, just floating around for the first time, just really taking it all in. Did they at least give you an opportunity to do that before the mission started?
Well, NASA doesn't allow any, they don't schedule a look out the window opportunity, but the reality is that you're going to have opportunities to do that. Sometimes on various flights, you may have more opportunities than others. On my three missions, they were all deployable missions, meaning we had satellites to deploy. It wasn't like a space lab where you're down in a lab and running experiments, in which case you're not going to have as much opportunity to look out the window. But when you have a deployable mission, after you deploy these things, typically the weight of the satellites that you're carrying up preclude having any other serious experiments aboard. So you will typically end up with time to actually look out the window and take photos, because various scientists and oceanographers want these photos taken from low Earth orbit to better understand things associated with the ocean, geology, volcanoes erupting, weather patterns, things like that. So on all three of my missions, I had plenty of time to look out that window. And it is incredibly beautiful. It really is. It's hard to get your head around how beautiful the world looks at from that altitude. The primary colors are black of space, blue of the ocean, white of the clouds. Those are the three primary colors. At night, you can see aurora borealis and aurora australis, the southern lights, northern lights. They look like green fire hanging in the sky up near the polar areas, and lightning flashing down on the ground, city lights, big cities. You can see those very easy. All of it's just incredibly beautiful.
And what's it like? You know, you grew up in New Mexico, and you know, I live in New York, and I don't have an opportunity really to look up and see much of anything. So when I go on vacation somewhere without so many city lights, I tend to take advantage of it. I would imagine New Mexico afforded you that ability growing up and probably sparked a lot of your interest in space. But when you came to the night side of the Earth, I'm sure the views were just spectacular.
They were. Actually, though, to be honest with you, if you're out in the West, West Rocky Mountain area, and you're above 10,000 feet, which puts you above most of the water vapor, is a very in an area where there's no other outdoor lights, it's totally just looking up at black sky and the stars. That is very close to what you will see from a space shuttle. I do a lot of backpacking in New Mexico, in Colorado, and at night it is like being in a planetarium. The immensity of stars that you can see in those situations is very similar to what you will see in a space shuttle. And actually, to be honest with you, when you're standing without any structure around you on Earth in one of these above 10,000 foot mountainous areas, away from any city lights, any lights whatsoever, it's even, I think, more impactful, because you don't have structure in the way. In a shuttle, when you're looking from the window, you always have some restriction on what you're seeing because of the structure. But it is glorious to look out the window into deep space when you're on the night side of the Earth. Actually, it's glorious to look at the Earth too. As I said, the city lights, the lightning flashing, the auroras, all of that is so incredibly beautiful.
So I've got to ask you a question about that, Mike. One of our other friends who isn't on tonight had asked that we ask you. He was asking about the overview effect, and if you had that, you know, seismic shift in your perception of the Earth after seeing it as this, you know, fragile ball just kind of hanging in space?
Well, actually, first of all, we don't see it as a ball. We're very close to the Earth in a shuttle and on the International Space Station. Those vehicles orbit low Earth orbit up about 200-300 miles. No shuttle has ever been above 400 miles. That's very, very close to Earth. And so it really fills the windows. It's hugely close. You can see that it's curved, but you can't see it as a disc, a ball, as the Apollo astronauts did when they were tens of thousands of miles from Earth. But for that reason, I never felt this detachment from humanity like I think you would feel if you were headed to the moon, for example, looking back, or certainly people headed to Mars. When you started going to Mars and you see our planet diminish to just basically being a blue-white morning star, like almost like a bigger, brighter Venus that we see here from Earth. In those situations, I can't imagine how that is going to affect a human being. I mean, you're going to think you are so detached from everything associated with human life, human evolution. It's now tens of millions of miles away as you're headed to Mars. But I didn't have a powerful sense that I was detached from humanity when I was aboard the space shuttle.
So, Mike, as you're orbiting, you're getting ready to call it quits on the mission and head back to Earth. I'd love for you to talk us through, just in the last couple of minutes we have with you tonight, what is the landing process like? I think you probably were afforded a softer landing than, you know, the Apollo astronauts, who kind of just careened down and splashed into the ocean. But at the same time, I'm sure it was equally, if not more, nerve-wracking, especially being in a brand new shuttle and it being your first flight. So what was that like?
Well, when you're in orbit, you have to obviously need some way of getting back. And the brake we use is the atmosphere. So you fire, we have some small rocket engines at the tail of the shuttle. We orient those facing forward as we're getting ready to come back in. So we fire those for a couple minutes, and those clip off a couple hundred miles an hour off our orbit speed. And that's all that's necessary now to change the orbit such that the low point of the orbit is now going to dip into the atmosphere. The atmosphere is our brake. You're going 17,500 miles an hour, and you got to slow down to be able to land on a runway at about 220 knots and ultimately come to a braking stop, just like an airplane. So a lot of energy has to be dissipated when you're coming back. So after you fire those braking rockets, if you will, slow down a couple hundred miles an hour, the vehicle is turned forward, pitched up 40 degrees nose high. So the belly of the shuttle is presented to the atmosphere as you fall in, because that's where all those heat shield tiles are. Everybody's familiar with those, I think. We have these heat silica tiles that are glued on the belly of the shuttle, glued all over the shuttle, actually, but on the belly of the shuttle on reentry. Those things will see temperatures varying between, well, up to 3,000 degrees on the very tip of the nose and the leading edge of the wings. But the belly sees more closer to maybe 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. So we enter the atmosphere. Initially, nothing changes for about 30 minutes or so. You're falling into the atmosphere, but it's so thin you don't really have a sense that anything has changed. You're still weightlessness. But then, as you hit the thin, thin atmosphere up around 70 miles or so, I remember the very first mission, I saw an M&M candy that had gotten loose somewhere in the cockpit, started this slow descent, which was the first descent, falling to the floor. That was the first indication that we were slowing down, because what's happening there is the vehicle is slowing down. But there's nothing to slow that M&M down until it hits the floor. So it's falling, basically. And that was the first visual indication that we were slowing down. And then as you get deeper into that thin atmosphere, you'll start seeing the fire, the what they call plasma. It heats the air up to 3,000 degrees as you're falling in. And you'll look out the windows and you'll see this white-hot glow. Starts as an orange glow and ultimately becomes a white hot and it wraps around the vehicle, and there's windows above the cockpit in the back. And if you look out those on reentry, you'll see this wake, being, it looks like a mini tornado of white hot 3,000 degree heated air that trails off into infinity above you as you're falling in. And as you get deeper in the atmosphere, it blows you more and more, it puts more speed off of you. You start feeling heavier G's as you start braking in the thicker atmosphere. All the while, now you started 12,000 miles away from where you want to land. We do our deorbit burn half an Earth around, half an orbit around. So we do our deorbit burn over the Indian Ocean. We fall across the Pacific, across Australia, across the Indian Ocean, I should say, across Australia, and across the Pacific, across the United States, and slowing down ever more and more until you arrive over the, all my missions were landing in California. So you arrive over Edwards Air Force Base with a couple hundred miles an hour, just like a regular airplane, and the pilot just flies in, lands like a regular airplane. It's an amazing process, incredible process, actually. The engineers that came up with it and all the heat piles that's necessary to protect you, it's amazing. It's really a feat of engineering.
Wow. I fly a lot for work, and I just can't imagine coming down from such a, it's a much different flight, I would say. Probably much better entertainment in flight, but much worse food.
Yeah, food's bad, but the whole thing from beginning to end, of course, is unique. It's beautiful. It's incredible. And then for me, it was a lifetime dream come true. So going back, though, we were talking about being out in the Southwest at night and seeing the night skies. When I was a kid, I would stand in the deserts of New Mexico and look up at the sky and see these early satellites twinkling through the twilight and dream of someday being aboard one of those. And then fast forward 25 years later, when I'm 39 years old on my first mission, I'm looking out the window down at those same deserts where I used to stand and look up. And that was having that lifetime dream come true was clearly the biggest, most momentous thing that is, well, I shouldn't say it's happened in my life. I have three children, and having three children is pretty momentous too. But obviously it ranks right up there in the top experiences that you can possibly have, is to have a lifetime dream come true. The whole circle there, to go from being the kid looking up to now being the astronaut looking down, certainly an amazing, amazing experience.
So Mike, coming back around full circle there, you got to see and experience kind of the full evolution from space flight, how it began when you were a kid, like watching, you know, Sputnik in your backyard over in New Mexico, to where we are today. I'm curious, what's next, right? What's next on the kind of the trajectory of space flight, both commercially and private, and through government organizations? You know, what are some next big achievements you see coming, and technological evolutions that are kind of yet to happen?
Well, the next big for NASA's plan is to go back to the moon and then on to Mars. That's NASA's plan. Now, there's President Trump has ordered NASA to get to the moon by 2024. They were shooting to get back there by 2028. And so now they've upped that to 2024. That is not going to happen unless more money comes NASA's way. In fact, this is something I've always been critical of presidents. Now, it doesn't matter which party, Republican or Democrat, does not matter. To me, they seem to use the space program as a photo opportunity. They'll go down when they're running for president or want to get reelected. They'll stand there at NASA and say, vote for me and we'll get back to the moon. We'll go on to Mars, do all these wonderful things. But then they never spend any political capital to get the money to do these things. And NASA's not getting but a pittance more than their normal budget to supposedly get to the moon by 2024. That is not going to happen. Absolutely. I would bet my mortgage on that, that we will not be on the moon in 2024 unless there's a lot more money forthcoming from the administration and Congress to do it. But NASA's plan is eventually to get back to the moon and then move on to Mars. And that I think is a long way in the future. There's, and primarily because of our, you know, we're human, and how do you guard our humanity for a better part of 3 years right now to get to Mars and back? How do we protect it from irradiation? What are the long-term effects of weightlessness, which we still don't know what 3 years will do? Nobody's ever been up there continuously for that much time. So there's a lot of unknowns associated with the human aspect of getting to the Mars. But I tell you, that said, there's a lot of wild cards out there, including SpaceX and Elon Musk. He wants to get to Mars a lot quicker than anything NASA wants to do. And the way that guy goes, I wouldn't discount it. I mean, he may well have people back on the moon before NASA does, and may have people on the way to Mars before NASA does. That guy is incredible with what he's been doing. You know, the rockets he's been developing and what he's continuing to develop. So Starhopper, I think, is Starhopper. He has a new one that he's testing that would be would go to Mars. So I would love to think I'm 74 years old. And when people use that expression, well, not in my lifetime. Well, the horizon is getting a lot closer than it used to be when you're 74. But I would love to be alive and see, certainly see us get back to the moon. And what would be wonderful is to see people headed to Mars. But I think even Elon Musk, that's a tough nut to crack. It's going to be way off in the future yet, I think.
Will you be applying for a seat on the ride to Mars?
No, I have no, you know, it's funny to ask that because I've been asked that, and I don't have a personality for that type of confinement. I really don't. In fact, I don't think I could do more than a month of, like on the ISS, the International Space Station. I guess I just like the Earth too much. I can't imagine being confined to a relatively small area, small volume, for the better part of 3 years. I've never been on a cruise, never have, and I never will. I can't imagine anything more adverse to my personality than being confined to something for, a week or whatever for a cruise, but certainly for months on a space station or years headed to Mars. I just don't have a personality that would be able to accommodate, to tolerate something like that. But there are other people out there that can do it. God bless them. I wish them the best of luck.
Well, Mike, first of all, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your stories with us. We got to get you back on at a later date to regale us in some of the stories from the Outpost Saloon, which we didn't get to on this episode. But to all of our listeners, Mike's book, Riding Rockets, The Outrageous Tales of a Space Shuttle Astronaut, is amazing. Fantastic read. You'll breeze through it, and you'll learn a heck of a lot. So, Mike, thank you again on behalf of Will, Mark, and I. Until next time, Space Cadets out!